Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Carla Long, and today you're listening to Percolating on Faith, but it's a little bit different to Percolating on Faith because we don't have Tony and Charmaine Chevalier-Smith, which we usually do, but they have introduced us to this topic of mystics. And I wanted to hear about more mystics, and I hope that you do too. So I've invited some very, very special guests to talk to us about what a mystic is and maybe even talk about some of their favorite mystics. So I have David Brock on the podcast with me. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, Carla.
Dave and I have been good friends for a very, very long time, for over 20 years. Well, maybe not quite like that, 18 years or something like that. It's been a long time, Dave. And I'm always happy to talk to him. So Dave, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Oh my. I live currently in Central Oregon, the birthplace of my wife, Carolyn, and we love it here. I've been retired from full-time church employment since 2016. Oh my, what a start here. And worked for the church for almost 40 years, most of it in international assignments, Latin America, Africa, the Pacific, that friendly country of Canada to our north. I'm a farm and ranch kid by birth from the Midwest, Kansas and Missouri, and I still marvel at the fact that I was able to see so much of the world during my time of employment with the church. So I'm grateful. I'm the father of Emily and the grandfather of August Ray Belmont, and Carolyn and I are happy grandparents recently and enjoying every second of it. So that's a little bit about me.
That was perfect. And Dave, I don't know why I always forget, but you're a Kansas person, just like me.
That's right.
We definitely have that in common. I love that.
We do.
So Dave, I think, I don't know if this is true or not, but I feel like we all might have slightly different definitions of what it means to be a mystic. So could you tell us what you think of when you think of the word mystic, maybe a definition, what it means to you?
Well, I think I'd like to share three or four definitions from the people who really know the topic. I will say personally that when I was in seminary, I read about the German mystics from like the 13th century. And something just resonated really deep within me about them. And through the years, I think most of us hear about St. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila and Meister Eckhart and some of those kind of famous mystics from the Middle Ages. And I've had a certain fascination about that, I think in part because I believe there's a mystic in all of us. And let me just share a couple of definitions. A mystic pursues a life vocation of union with God, passionately seeking direct encounters with the divine. A mystic is someone who has undergone a transformation from which they emerge in the realized oneness of God, self, and all things. A mystic is anyone who has the gnawing suspicion that the apparent discord, brokenness, contradictions, and discontinuities that assault us every day might conceal a hidden unity. And just one last one. I've got a bunch of them, but it speaks of deep yearning, of burning desire for the contemplation and presence of the divine beloved. We can talk about the famous mystics and we can talk about definitions that are nuanced and profound and all that. But basically, it's a mystic as a person who has the deep desire to be in connection with the divine. I think that's just a simple one. A heart open to see the extraordinary in the ordinary.
I really love that. You know, when I was talking with Tony Charmaine about what it meant to be a mystic, I was pretty much 100% convinced that I wasn't a mystic, that I had no mystic in me at all. And they pretty much convinced me that, like you're saying, everybody has a mystic inside of them. I'm convinced that there's, because it's not like you have to go out into the woods and sit and like contemplate nature for hours at a time, because I would get way too hungry to do that. But I mean, that yearning for God is the most important part. So I have been appreciating mystics more the more I hear about them. So I'm really excited to have this conversation with you.
I think part of, yeah, thanks, Carla. I think, as you know, as I read about sort of the hero mystics through the ages, you know, the A team, as it were, I thought, you know, there have to be mystics in our own movement, our own restoration movement, our own 1800s on through. And so I began to do some thinking about who are the mystics in our community. And I think most of the mystics in Community of Christ were just ordinary folk, our ordinary folk. In the early days, it was people whose names we may not know, from upstate New York, from Kirtland, from Nauvoo, from Independence, from Lamoni. And then now it's the coal miners in Wales back in the 1830s. It's people in Sao Paulo, in Lubumbashi, in Chengdu, China, in Horconcitos, Honduras. It's all those places. But I thought today that I'd like to single out a couple of mystics who some listening would be familiar with them. One is David Hiram Smith, and the other is Ed Guy. And they're from two very different chronological eras, but they're also two very different people. And yet I would define both as mystics within our movement.
Well, that sounds fascinating, and I'm really excited. David Hiram Smith is definitely someone that our listeners will certainly know. I don't know if everybody knows Ed Guy, so let's get started. Let's do it.
Okay. Well, let's start with David Hiram Smith, and I'll just give you a little background. He was born on November 17th, 1844, at the homestead in Nauvoo, Illinois. He was the youngest son of Joseph Jr., Joseph the prophet. But never met his father, because his father was killed in Carthage 5 months before he was born. And he was the ninth child of Emma, my goodness. But David became a prominent leader in the church in the reorganization, and known as a painter, a singer, a philosopher, a theologian, a naturalist, a preacher, a poet, a hymn writer. And he was given the moniker, the nickname Sweet Singer of Israel, primarily related to his hymn writing. Mark Shear, our church historian for many years, said his greatest gift may have been his artistic creativity, which shaped his worldview. All who knew him well understood the complexity of his life and sensed their loss when his mental health declined. And we'll get to that a little later. It's a beautiful story, but it's also a tragic story. His family and his neighbors portrayed him in some of the following ways. A child who gave his mother much comfort, gentle, cautious, reserved, loved pets. At age 8, he was described as seeming to be never so happy as when he has a pencil and paper in his hand. David is the boy of all boys, Joseph III said, the pet of the family, the very personification of gentleness and goodness, a warm temperament with quick-witted powers of perceptions. Charles Derry said he's all of life. He's all of life, full of poetry, a very sensitive nature. He abhorred guns, and in sharp contrast to his brother Alexander, learned to respond to opposition with diplomacy and tact. He very good with words, obviously, as we'll see. And some, a lot of that had to do with his mom. His mother, Emma, was actually a school teacher, and she had a home library, and that's where he began to learn grammar and those kind of things. And then when there was a group of French socialists called the Icarians and German immigrants who came to Nauvoo during his childhood, it's been after his dad's death, of course, and after the divisions in the church and all that. But he began to learn French and probably some German and those kind of things. So language was very important to him and a very much interest. And then he loved to roam the woods around Nauvoo. And some of you who are listening again will know about David's Chamber, which is we still know it as that. But that's a place I've been, and some of you have been, where there's a little waterfall and a stream flowing through. And apparently David spent a lot of time there in his more contemplative nature. Jason Briggs said that he could, by the Spirit, sing off new hymns and in new tunes, often when the Spirit rested on him. W.W. Blair said he sang the songs of Zion, many of them his own compositions, till we all forgot the sorrowful world without and felt that paradise was well nigh regained and we were made to rejoice. So lots and lots of hymns, and we'll get to a couple of those that I'll share. But he also wrote for children. He did a lot of writing for the Herald and other church publications. And I found this this little writing, a quote, a paragraph from his writing to children, to be the mind of a mystic who pays so much attention to the little things of life and sees all the grandeur of the cosmos and those little things. But he's just writing about a simple glass of water. And he says to the children, "Let us set it down right here on the corner of the table, where this little ray of sunshine may shine into it. Ah, see the little rainbow of colors at the bottom of it, the merry sparkles all through the glass, the shimmering bubbles on the surface, and the bead-like drops round the brim. We must learn to use our eyes, Jenny, for the purest pleasure we shall enjoy in life will be in looking at the works of God in man." And if you read poetry or you read poetic prose, you'll notice how some people are able to see things that many of us just miss. We're just not as attentive. And that, I think, that was very much the spirit of David and is often very much the spirit of a mystic. So a little bit about his hymns, hymns I grew up with. Now that I'm an old guy, some of you won't know some of these hymns because they're not in the current hymnals. But one of the ones I can remember singing as a child was, "Let us shake off the colds from our garments and arise in the strength of the Lord. Let us break off the yoke of our bondage and be free in the joy of the word. For the pebble hath dropped in the water and the waves circle round with the shock. Shall we anchor our bark in the center or drift out and be wrecked on the rock?" A number of hymns, "A Calm and Gentle Spirit, Let Us Pray for One Another, Worldly Cares a Moment Leave Us, and "You May Sing of the Beauty of Mountain and Dale, of the Silvery Streamlet and Flowers of the Vale, but the place most delightful this earth can afford is the place of devotion, the house of the Lord. You may boast of the sweetness of day's early dawn, of the sky's softening graces where day is just gone, but there's no other season or place can compare with the house of devotion, the season of prayer." And during that time, he also began to write poetry, some about his father and his uncle, martyrs of the church, but a lot of his poetry was more about his own exploration of his own depths. "I stand upon the shore of a wide sea, whose unknown depths profound I soon must cross when the last sand of life runs out for me. The clouds have fled. I look back on my life and find it brighter than I was aware." So David began to travel with his brother Alexander and sometimes with Joseph III as they went to Utah to combat ideas that Joseph was a polygamist, and they tried to win converts to the then RLDS church, but they had a lot of, you know, tough times, obviously, and I won't go into the details about that. But he became well known and was well loved out there until he began to stand up against Mormon perspectives and some of the Mormon leadership who were trying to convert. Drawing on his ability with words, his genial disposition, his gentle humor, and his ability to see beauty in nature, he held his own in the public eye. But for this delicate, poetical, highly sensitive child of sorrow, the tragic battle with mental illness was about to begin. And some of that, people surmise, is that there was so much tension and struggle in Utah for this sensitive person, who also began to realize that maybe his father did indeed practice polygamy. It was very troubling to him. But in March of 1870, he went back home to, he was living in Plano, Illinois at that time, and continued to court Clara Charlotte Hartshorne of Sandwich, Illinois, with whom he'd fallen in love earlier. So they were married in May of 1870 and moved into the Nauvoo Mansion House. And it was there a year or so later, in March 1871, that Elbert A. was born. And Elbert A., again, many of you will know, had prominent roles in the church, including being in the presidency and also presiding patriarch evangelist for 20 years. But I thought we'd look at some examples of his connection to nature and what he wrote about that in sermons and speeches or sketches. So he's in Utah and he writes, "The distant mountains hung on the horizon's verge, blue and white, blue with shadowy ravines and white with snow, cloud-like and dim and vast. Now sinking below the swell of the vast plain, now rising again the same, following us like a phantom." And then he's on the observation deck of a train that's headed west, and he says this, "The expression of the plains is exactly that of the sea." This is for a Kansan, like you and me, Carla. "Vastness, what Ruskin calls infinity and freedom. The mind seems to expand while gazing upon them. Thoughts of eternity, of everlasting life, swell the heart with grateful praise. This sometimes, in looking upon the far stretches reaching away to the horizon, is impressed so keenly on the mind as to be almost painful, accompanied as it is by a sense of loneliness." And then, in 1872, while he's out in Utah, he writes this treatise, 9,000 words, called De Profundis, or From the Depths. And what he's trying to do, which is very much a mystical kind of thing to do, is he's trying to integrate science and theology. And here's a paragraph from that. He says, "We need not be troubled in regard to the stability of the planets in their spheres. Neither need we fret as regards the source of the energy of the sun or earth, nor fear its expenditure, for its origin is co-eternal with matter. There is unity in the universe. Man is a tide, a stream flowing over the earth. Our individuality is only in part. We are finally meant to be in union with God and the Lamb." And I, you know, that's a way of writing that is 1800s kind of writing. But what it points out to me is this common thread among the mystics through the ages about all being unity, or everything is connected. And, you know, from in those days, the smallest cell to what was understood of the cosmos and God in and through all those things uniting us together. So that's all part of David. And then as time goes on, his illness begins, and you know, there's ideas about what that was and whether with today's medications a chemical imbalance could have been improved, all that, but it's a tragic story. But he's out in California doing church work in this would have been around 1875, 77 or whatever. And he writes a letter to his mother in which he says, "Mother," and this is in 1870 actually, he says, "Mother, I must tell you, I feel happy sometimes, most always, but today and last night, I feel very sad and the tears run out of my eyes all the time and I don't know why. I have to work away as tight as I can clip to keep the rest from seeing it. I wonder if something sad is going to happen. Strive as I will, my heart sinks like lead. So I must go to work or I will make you feel sad too. I must tell someone my troubles or I should, well, I don't know what. God bless you, mother, from your child." And that one just about tears me apart. And because he and his mother had a very close relationship. And the last thing he would want to do is to hurt his mother. But this is a point where he's so desperate that he has to say someone and he entrusts this to her. And so this sweet singer of Israel is beginning to descend into a deep and dark place. And finally, the family tries to keep him at home, but he begins to cause so many problems that Joseph III finally says, we have to put him in an asylum. And so that's what happens. I think that was in 1877 that it says, on January 19th, accompanied by the town constable of Plano, Illinois, Joseph took David the 35 long miles north to the asylum. So he died on August the 29th, 1904, just 3 months shy of his 60th birthday. And he was buried in Lamoni in the Rose Hill Cemetery, which again, many of us who hear this will know that place. And a memorial message from California from people who loved him said, "We note the humble grace and sweet humility that marks his mien. We see the man, we note his calling, but ere our hopes were fully born, we saw the shadows gather and blossoms fade. The life long scarce had sound, the life song scarce had sounded its once exultant key till notes of melancholy sounding like knell monopolized the strain. The brightest colors of the picture grew dim and somber and our prophecy erased." Well, I'm feeling very sad as I share this, but just we'll close out here on David by saying, "The sweet singer of Israel was no more, but the memory of the church's most promising philosopher, public speaker, poet, and hymn writer remain." Perhaps the words of a letter from David to Joseph in Joseph III in 1871, expressing his desire to return to Utah, captured best the spirit of this self-proclaimed wanderer outward bound. Here's what he says: "Now I have made bold to endeavor to encourage and to tell of a probable journey and its opening and to speak my inner thoughts to you. My aim is honor. My happiness is love. My destination is Christ's bosom. My hunger is righteousness. My thirst is purity." So to close, I just reflect on why does David H. Smith speak to me? And I think I would summarize it by saying I'm moved by the disciplines of observation and attentiveness in David's drawings, which I didn't mention. There's a lot of artwork. And in fact, I have a number of images of his artwork, mostly drawings, not paintings, some paintings of scenes of nature and his paintings of the landscape of Nauvoo in the West. And if you've ever seen a painting of old Nauvoo, that's David's painting. I'm moved by the connections between creation and creator, the now and the eternal in his hymnody. I'm moved by the honest struggle and longing in his poetry. I'm moved by his exploration of the relationship between science and religion. An amazing, amazing person in the life of our movement.
Wow, that is amazing. I of course have known of David Hyrum Smith. I did not know of all of that. I did not realize he spent so much time in Utah, for instance. But I think Utah could maybe even make a poet out of me. I mean, it's so beautiful. I don't know about you, but when I think about that time in our church history, you know, the 1830s, 40s, 50s, 60s, whatever, I think about it more as being a time of turmoil. And I rarely think about it as a time of beauty and a time of, that you can find beautiful things within it. So it's actually really refreshing to me to hear that David Hyrum Smith saw that beauty, even through his pain, because, oh my gosh, that letter that you read almost made me cry. So I really enjoyed hearing about that, the beautiful words that he found and all of that stuff too.
Yeah, well, you've said it well, Carla, and I think that is why his voice, his story merits being heard many times. He did a lot to shape the early movement, and that still shapes us today. And it is an invitation to encounter with the divine in nature, in tiny little things, and even in the tragedy and struggle of life, which we all experience in some ways, as did many of the mystics.
Yeah, so, they were just very good at saying them, very good at expressing their feelings. So thank you so much for that trip, that story about David Hyrum Smith. I think that we have some more time if you want to talk about Ed Guy.
Okay, I'd be happy to share. And as I say, this is a different personality, a different era, but another amazing hero of the faith in my estimation. So it's Edward Ellsworth Guy, was born in Santa Monica, California on August 26th, 1934. His parents were Florence and John, and his dad was born in England and then grew up in Vancouver and Calgary, Canada, then moved to the U.S. to work as an airplane mechanic, and later became a much sought-after engineer, worked for TWA, and was assigned during the war years to work with the military and federal government. So because of that, they moved quite a bit. They were in California, they were in Missouri, they were in Washington, D.C., they were in Washington, they were in Oregon. So Ed kind of grew up in all those places. And he had interestingly enough, kind of connecting with David Hyrum Smith, he had a really close relationship to his mom, who was a very dedicated disciple and very deeply immersed in the reorganization and those kind of things. His dad was not a member and maybe not a Christian, but a good man. So Ed went to Graceland College in Iowa, and after a year of being at Graceland, he just goes, oh, this is not for me. So he joined the Army and went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma for a couple of years, and then decided to try college again. So he graduated from Central Washington College, got his bachelor's degree then, and then he went back to the Kansas City area and got a master's degree in social work from the University of Missouri. But what, you know, what we know Ed most for is that he lived for almost 50 years, I would say, in Latin America or associated with Latin America. He lived in Mexico, he lived in Honduras, he lived in Guatemala, he lived in El Salvador. And any account of his life is a profile of a servant ministry. So he would, you know, he'd give his last peso or lempita or dollar or whatever money it was. He'd throw in a shirt and shoes if necessary. He slept on dirt floors and narrow benches. He accompanied the sick, the dying, the imprisoned. He prayed with those who feared for their lives as bullets flew through homes and shops during El Salvador's civil war. He started projects to bring a small income to refugees in tent camps. He saved a drug-addicted woman, literally retrieved from a gutter in San Salvador, and over many years nurtured her one faltering step at a time back to safety and health. He helped the endangered escape to Canada in an underground railroad of sorts, saving the lives of those marked for murder in the 1980s during the terrible civil war in El Salvador. After the mass killings in El Salvador and Guatemala, he worked tirelessly and at great risk to expose the unspeakable crimes and help families recover the remains of loved ones from unmarked graves. He anointed the heads of the ill and prayed for healing. He walked into family and community conflict as peacemaker and reconciler. He told the stories of the Bible and Book of Mormon. He helped plant churches in mining towns and remote mountain villages amidst the chaos and daily scramble for survival in the urban centers of Mexico and Central America. So that's all true, but it's also true that the guy, Ed, he could make you laugh and he'd tell you stories about, like, he was a smoke jumper in Idaho and some of the wildest, scariest tales. And then he worked in fishing vessels off the coast of Alaska for a lot of years. In fact, when he was in Latin America, he'd run out of money because he'd give it all away. So he'd go work in Alaska on a fishing boat and make money and then go back to Latin America. In the midst of all that, he didn't take very good care of himself, had congestive heart failure, and he died of a heart attack on the streets of Guatemala City on a mission to work with an organization that was bringing justice for families of the disappeared. Here's some things his brother-in-law says about him, which I think capture Ed really well. He says, all you had to do was tell Ed about your cause, and it became Ed's cause too. Ed was passionate about what he believed in, passionate in his desire to help, passionate in his desire to give aid and comfort, and passionate in his desire for justice. Wherever there was suffering, Ed suffered. Wherever there was injustice, Ed agonized. And wherever there was pain, Ed anguished. Ed was always searching for what more he could do to help. He accepted these challenges willingly, but no one can sustain the amount of emotional punishment Ed endured, and no one's heart, even filled with as much love as Ed's was, can survive the frustration of living in a world with so much pain, suffering, and injustice. Ed had an open mind and an open heart, no preconceived notions, no judgments. He was never condescending, never patronizing. He was a teacher and he was a learner. He was a talker. Oh man, was he a talker. Actually, Ed was the poster child for the dangers of caffeine. Once he got that motor running, the best thing to do was just hang on or just get out of the way. I thought that needs to be in this podcast, which speaks of those kinds of things. Edward, the cornerstone of Ed's life was his faith. His faith was unyielding, steadfast, resolute, tenacious, and absolute. Ed's faith was what bound him, what motivated him, what inspired him, what gave him joy, and what ultimately gave him the strength to sacrifice his life. Edward Ellsworth Guy literally gave his life in the service of others. He did it willingly, consciously, and without hesitation. He asked for and expected nothing in return. So this is more personal, but I want to share about a week I spent with Ed the first time I met him. And just, I think it gives a pretty good sense of who he is and what his life was like. And then we'll get more specifically into some things about his mystical tendencies, as it were. So here we go. I met Ed in January 1978 when Thad Wilson organized the first Community of Christ youth camp in Honduras. I was living in Mexico City, so flew into San Pedro Sula for the event. At the end of the camp, Ed asked if we, Thad and I, would accompany him to offer ministry in El Carreto on Sunday morning. Eager for adventure, I said yes, not knowing what we were in for. We arose early after a night of rain and for 3 hours climbed the slippery mountain to the home of the Hernandez family. We arrived to the best cup of coffee, roasted, ground, and prepared right there that I had ever tasted, then shared in a memorable worship. Sometimes Ed rode a horse through the mountains. Occasionally he hitchhiked on the seldom traveled dirt and gravel roads. Mostly he walked, often by whatever moonlight was available, as he arose early enough to get from Saturday night services in one village to morning services up the mountain. Or he would lead a class in San Pedro Sula, finish in time to catch a vehicle to Lake Yohoa, paddle across, often in the agitated waves of late afternoon, and arrive for an evening service at Orconcitos. Then he would often sleep on a narrow bench at the church. After worship and a meal in El Carreto on that Sunday of January 1978, we were able to catch a Land Rover headed down the logging road. We stopped in a small town along the way and learned that there had been a knife fight at a wedding the night before. Because of the conflict, Ed stayed behind to try to bring reconciliation. He sent us back to La Buena Fe, promising to catch up later. The next day, we returned to San Pedro Sula without Ed, who was still dealing with the crisis on the mountain, you know, the knife fight. He showed up in the early morning of the following day, and along with 70 Tony Jimenez, we drove to Chimaltenango, Guatemala. We traveled to the village where Ed had worked following the devastating earthquake of 1976. We made our way down a steep logging road into La Estancia de la Virgen to meet Rolando and his family and share with them in conversation and prayer. As the sun moved across the sky, we kept insisting to Ed that we best leave the valley while there was still light. Because the road was so steep, Tony's pickup couldn't climb the valley road. We climbed out and pushed until exhausted. We were tired and not a little frustrated with Ed for getting us into this mess. He chided us gently by saying this was the Lord's work and we needed to have more faith and pray for God's help. This is what ministry is all about, he told us. We were in no mood to pray there on the mountain, exhausted from pushing the vehicle whose tires were now significantly worn down. So we made Ed pray, and we pushed and muttered and tried to be more pleasant, faithful, and prayerful. Before long, we were on an easier road where Ed had us stop to praise God for protecting us on the way. That's how my relationship with Ed began. And then we didn't have much interaction until in 1994, when I began a six-year assignment as the apostle for Latin America. And by that time, Ed was no longer living in Honduras, but he was in El Salvador. As I visited members and friends of the church in El Salvador, I heard story after story of persons whose lives had been saved by Ed during the war, literally. Persons who were sent to safety on an underground railroad from El Salvador to Canada. Persons to whom Ed delivered much needed food in conflicted neighborhoods by skirting the rebels and or talking his way past government soldiers, sometimes with the benefit of a handkerchief waved as a white flag. He once saw a soldier about to shoot an unarmed rebel. Ed jumped from behind a building, ran into the street, and yelled at the soldier, "In the name of God, I command you not to kill that man." The shocked soldier turned and ran, and Ed thanked God. Ed was a man of the people. He lived with the poor. He lived as the poor. He was a person of adventure and risk, in part because of his personality, but more so because of his faith and his values. He was a man of prayer, a man who knew the value of his own personal prayer and meditation time time alone midst the constant pressing presence of others. He could just as easily pray on a street corner or in a circle of seekers in a noisy market as in a church building. He prayed around countless hospital beds, but also while lying on the floor of a house reciting Psalm 91, I think it is, praying the flying bullets would not kill his friends. You will not fear the terror of night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence that stalks in the darkness, nor the plague that destroys at midday. He prayed just as naturally in those circumstances as in congregational worship. The scriptures mattered to Ed. He read them, meditated on them, memorized them, preached and taught them. He knew the stories of Jesus. They were models and guides that shaped his life and ministry. Bible and Book of Mormon stories were his story, woven into the days, nights, and decades of his life. He believed deeply in the sacraments, especially baptism and laying on of hands for the sick. As Daryl Mink, appointing minister to Latin America for many years, often said, Ed was a true Christian, a person of faith who made you a person of faith. He believed and answered prayer, and if you were around him long enough, you'd be a believer too. Ed would get you into the wildest situations, pretty much daily, in fact. Often he had to drag you because it was untimely, inefficient, unplanned, impractical, and dangerous. Afterward, you realized what he did was what Jesus would have done, and you were a richer person for having participated. He often relied on his intuition to guide him. Sometimes when he entered a space, you could see him subtly use his downturned open hand to feel whether there was good energy or bad in the room. He paid attention to vibes, he called them, that he got in the presence of strangers. He entertained almost every stranger as the Christ. He could always find the good in anyone, no matter how hidden. On occasion, however, particularly during the years of civil war, he learned to trust his intuitions regarding whether another person was a danger to him or others. He said he could feel evil. I learned not to question him. He neglected his own self-care. He had pills for congestive heart failure, which we found rolling freely in plastic bottles in an otherwise empty suitcase. He said they made him feel funny, so he stopped taking them. Doctors who he rarely saw recommended a change in eating habits, but he loved his salt and soft drinks and never ate anything but what those around him ate. He often went without. If he bought food, he bought the cheapest. The years of exposure to bacteria and parasites took their toll. He usually laughed it off. Illness slowed him, though. As he aged, he took longer to get started at the beginning of the day, but he never lost his drive to get up, to go, to do, to be with. Never. He never married. There's a story of a Honduran woman who loved him and for whom he held considerable affection. She would have welcomed marriage, but he continued his outward bound ways. Gone for 7 years, he returned to find that she had married. Ed said he likely would have married her if she had just waited a little longer. Oh, my, what a guy. Well, there's so much to tell, but I'll begin to draw this to a close by saying that the person of the moment was the one who mattered for Ed. There might be a government agency appointment to keep. There might be tactics to catch. There might be sermons to preach. But if a person in need arrived or was in his path, all his future plans were of little significance until the present need was attended to. And I will confess that that could be very frustrating at times, but Jesus-like. So how do you argue with that? Like the mystics of the ages, Ed shared an intimacy with God that most of us don't have, at least not often. He embodied so many of the fruits of the Spirit in his living. He lived out the principles and values that many of us hold up and talk about, but only sporadically demonstrate. I don't think I've met another human being who valued equally the poorest person alongside the rich and famous. No one, absolutely no one, was more sensitive to the well-being of those wounded by life, unacknowledged or unaware of their worth. Ed was savvy, but there was an innocence about him, a naivete, a simple childlike faith in God and humanity. He understood, I think, that God is mystery. God is transcendent and other. Mostly for Ed, however, God was personal, intimate, imminent, Abba. God was engaged in every aspect and detail of life. Ed was given, along with Ed and Marina Ramos de Marino, the Human Rights Award for Service to Humanity at the 1994 World Conference. And Loreen Hageman, who was chair of the Human Rights Committee, shared the following. Woven through all his labors are ministries of spiritual comfort and pastoral sensitivity. He demonstrates a powerful faith, high personal values, and a boundless love for persons of all stations in life. Perhaps the impact and effectiveness of the ministry and service of Edward Guy are best perceived in the hundreds of persons who call out to him by name in city streets and byways where he has been a force for the highest ideals of Christianity. He's a living paradigm of the Good Samaritan. Lloyd Hirschman summarized Ed's years of service by saying this, perhaps very few are called to be homeless in order to reach out to the homeless, to be hungry if by that means the hungry might be fed, to sacrifice health and life expectancy that others might live. But to Edward Ellsworth Guy, human being of note, that is the normal course of life. When Ed died in Guatemala on September 21st, 2001, church members from El Salvador and Guatemala arranged for a viewing and worship before his body was returned to the United States for burial. They didn't have enough money to buy a casket, so quietly worked out an unofficial arrangement to rent a casket for a few hours. Ed would have been quite okay with that and undoubtedly would have found it humorous. He would have been angry, in fact, if his friends had wasted their limited finances to otherwise honor his death. He's buried near his father and mother in Bayview Cemetery near Samish Island, Washington. His tombstone simply reads, "Well done, good and faithful servant."
Wow. Wow. Like, when you said you wanted to talk about Ed Guy, I'd heard the name before, but I literally had no idea. I think I sat here and listened to you with my mouth open like the whole time when you described his life. Like, I don't know him like you did. But I mean, the way you describe him is not how I picture a mystic at all. Like I said, I picture a mystic, someone going out in the trees and looking at trees. This is not that guy.
This guy is not that guy.
Literally. I'm just astounded. And how cool that you worked with him. That's very cool.
Yeah. One of the great privileges. And like I said, you know, sometimes he could be very frustrating because you'd have your calendar all worked out and you're going to be there for just a few days and we got to do this, and that. And he would just blow that to pieces because there might be a sick person lying in the street or somebody comes running to say this person is sick. And that was your agenda.
So. I'm sure it would drive me absolutely insane. Like he's someone that I would really, really want to be around and someone I would not want to be around all at the same time.
Yeah.
Well, that is just fascinating. I have learned so much from you today, Dave. It's been a really wonderful podcast. Thank you so much for sharing, especially sharing mystics from Community Christ / RLDS history. I think that our people and friends of Community Christ need to realize that we definitely have lots and lots of mystics in our movement as well. In fact, it helps balance us out from all of the heart people and head people and kingdom people that we have as well.
Yeah, well said. Well said. Yeah, there are a lot of heroes in this little community of ours, and they need to be celebrated.
They do. We certainly stand on the shoulders of giants. Well, Dave, thank you so much again for taking the time and for delivering your expertise to us about David Hiram Smith and about Edward Ellsworth Guy, I think it was. Yes. I only remember because I have an Uncle Ellsworth. That name stuck with me. Yeah. So it's a good old fashioned Kansas name. So thanks again, Dave. It's just been wonderful.
Thank you. My privilege, Carla.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.